This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. My guest this week on Dreamland is Ronnie Pontiac. He is a writer, a scholar of esoteric traditions, and a longtime explorer of the hidden currents that run beneath our spiritual history. You may know Ronnie from his years working with the legendary mystic Manly P. Hall, whose influence helped Ronnie deep down in his own engagement with the unseen world and wisdom traditions. His new book, The Unobstructed Way, is a remarkable guide to an idea that appears again and again across cultures and centuries, that awakening is not something we must struggle to achieve, but something that emerges when the obstacles created by our own minds fall away. Ronnie joins us to talk about the unobstructed way and about the profound simplicity that may be at the heart of genuine awakening. And we're going to have a really remarkable journey back into the past. And we're going to start with a spiritual seeker that you probably have never heard of, who's got a lot to tell us about the afterlife, this life, and how they intersect. Ronnie, welcome to Dreamland.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And we're going to see what we can do in exploring this today. Now, you start the book with The Unobstructed Way with Stuart Edward White and Betty Grant White. And I was rather surprised. In fact, you know, I've seen so many books like this, sort of on this same general subject, I might not have even texted you about it, except that suddenly I found myself reading about someone I really hadn't thought about in a long, long time. And why did you go back to them? Tell us about them.
Well, when my wife Tamara and I were researching my book on American metaphysical religion, we ran into this story, and we had been told long ago by an amazing psychic that we met that Tamara should read the Betty books, as they were called. And she attempted it several times, but she found it very difficult. Stuart had kind of a early 20th century style of writing, and it took him a long time to get to his point. Eventually, Tamara said to me, when we were working on the very beginnings of the American Metaphysical Religion book, could you please translate this for me into modern English? Because I can't make heads or tails out of what they're trying to say, and I want to know why I was told to read it. So I began to read the books, and I was astonished by what I found there. And they became our favorite story of all the hundreds of stories we researched for my book. And so we decided that we would not only research, but we would practice some of the techniques that are provided there. And we found them to be life-changing. And so Tamara eventually said that this was so important and so dear to her heart that she wanted to, if at all possible, to, in a sense, revive these teachings and at least make them available to a new generation in a more palatable way. So we set about doing that. And they were extremely famous books in the 1930s and the 1940s. It's strange how they lapsed into total obscurity. Their most famous book, The Unobstructed Universe, was published in 1940, and it was so popular that the publisher had to reprint it every 2 months for a year. And yet, when we started to research them, we could find almost nothing. Their books were hard to get. There was no information about them as people, except about Stuart being a pretty well-known writer, at the time famous, but at this point barely known, writer of frontier books and adventure books for kids, westerns, many of which were turned into films by Disney and other early studios. And we had to go into court records and newspaper records to find information about them. And then we read all the books, which had a little bit of biographical information scattered throughout it. We found something that amazingly reflected, as Stuart says in one of the books, all the religious teachings. He said that he received letters from people who were high up in virtually every religion in the world, who all wrote him after reading these books and said, "You have described the core of our religion." And that was also what we discovered.
That's really interesting. And one of the things that drew me to this book is this attempt that you're making to recover something of obviously extraordinary value. I mean, it is very valuable. You're right about that, I think. And I thought to myself, here I am with all of this knowledge of this subject. I know nothing about them. I've never heard of them at all. And life-changing is a good word, a good phrase. So let's get into exactly why it is a good phrase. Let's start with the Ouija board incident of 1919. And now, folks, I know a lot of people in this world, as soon as they hear the words Ouija board, they go into a kind of a state of, oh dear. And these things are all as good or bad as we are. When you use a Ouija board, if you take your darkness, it will reflect that. If you take your light, it will reflect that. So on that basis, let's talk about the 1919 experience.
Okay, I'll give you a very short background so we know who we're dealing with. Stuart was born around 1875, and he was somebody who had extensive experience of life on the frontier. He was a gold miner. He was a lumberjack. He was a frontier scout. He was somebody who explored wildernesses in America and in Africa. He was a good friend of Teddy Roosevelt, and Roosevelt said that Stuart was the best shot he ever met with a pistol or a rifle. And he married Betty, who was a kind of, he used to call her a mongrel because she had such varied backgrounds, but she came from a very wealthy family. She was raised in Panama and Bermuda and Florida. And when they met, it was instant love. It took a while for him to convince her parents to allow them to marry because he was this rough frontiersman, even though he was quite successful. And he took her on a honeymoon that was 4 months of just the two of them camping in the Sierras when they were wilderness. And he was delighted to discover that she loved it and she flourished in his lifestyle. So these were people that were very used to exploration and to being in wilderness territories and such. And Stuart says that he did not believe in spiritualism. He thought that it had all been proven to be fraudulent. But here they were on St. Patrick's Day at the house of a friend who'd been experimenting with a Ouija board. And so he decided to bring the Ouija board out. Betty was very reluctant to use it, like a lot of people today. She thought it had a bad reputation. And they were being a little facetious. They used a whiskey glass instead of the planchette. And at first it was just kind of laughter. But then it started to spell out Betty, Betty, Betty. She thought they were playing a trick on her, but they insisted they were not. And they asked her, well, come over here. Obviously, it wants to talk to you. And so she eventually came over to prove that she wasn't afraid. And when she did, the whiskey glass started going around in circles. Stuart described it as like a happy puppy. And then all it would say is, get a pencil, get a pencil, get a pencil. Well, once again, she thought this was some kind of joke. But then a day or two later, she was sitting at her vanity, and she had a piece of paper and a pencil. And to her shock, her hand began to move involuntarily. very slowly. In the beginning, it might take an hour to form just one word, but the movement was undeniable. And eventually it began to flow a little better. Stuart was very curious about this. He was a great explorer, and here was some kind of a mystery going on. What was happening? Was this his wife's subconscious, or was it some sort of strange telepathy? What were these words? At first, the messages weren't particularly impressive, but then as she got a flow to it, the messages were really impressive, and they seemed to Stuart to not be originating from Betty. And so he encouraged her to continue to do this, and she would blindfold herself and then would start to do this automatic writing. Eventually, he was so impressed that he organized these notes, and he actually released a book in 1925 that contained the philosophy, but didn't go into too much detail about where he got it. He admitted that it was about mediumship, but not that it was his wife or the depth of their exploration. And he still had a little skepticism. His point of view was, I'm not sure where this is coming from, but it makes a lot of sense to me, so I'm going to share it to you. And the publisher took a risk, and they published it to see how it would go over. And it went over very well. But to their disappointment, the spirits they were working with, who they called themselves the Invisibles, because they felt that the word spirit had unfortunate connotations, they said, well, this part of the exploration is over, and so no more automatic writing. And they were very disappointed. But then Stuart was traveling on business, and he found a book that had been written just after World War I that was a huge bestseller, and it was about a soldier who came back from the afterlife to talk about his experiences there, and also contained some warnings about the fact that there was another war looming ahead that was going to be even worse. So Stuart reached out to the authors of the book, who were a couple who used the pseudonym Darby and Joan, which back then was slang for a happily married couple. They were actually a couple of newspaper people, journalists and authors, and Darby was somebody who had a lot of experience in the newspaper business. And so they hit it off very well, and they found out that Joan had become a voice medium instead of using automatic writing. And Betty was interested in exploring that, so Joan helped her learn how to become a voice medium. Betty was not like Edgar Cayce. She did not go to sleep. She got into a trance state, and she was present and would actually comment on the readings. Usually they were in her own voice. Sometimes they came out with an accent. And sometimes, according to Stuart, rarely, but sometimes, they would not seem to come from her at all, but from somewhere near her. And it started the same way. It was slow in the beginning and awkward, but then it became amazing. And once again, she was using a blindfold. So to give you an example of the kind of thing that convinced Stuart, she's blindfolded, and she's dictating what the Invisibles are telling her, and he's writing it down. And he wrote down attitude, and she said, no, not attitude, Stuart, altitude. Now, she had no way to see what he was writing or to know what he had written. He said that there were hundreds of these kinds of examples, and as he put it, he was driven to accept the reality of this, because he said that it became ridiculous to deny it, more ridiculous than to accept it. And there were also so much accuracy in what they were telling. So it all started with the Ouija board, but it wound up with this mediumship. But this was not the kind of mediumship that we're all used to hearing about. These were not health readings or past life readings or stories about Atlantis or such. This was a different kind of experiment that the Invisibles were conducting. And the point of it was to teach Betty to achieve the after-death consciousness while she was still in the body. Or as Betty put it, her mission was to demonstrate the here-ness of immortality. Because she said, those of us who believe in it think usually that it's there, that maybe we experience it when we die. But she was saying, no, this immortality is here right now. And she was also teaching that consciousness is the starting point for everything. So there is nothing in our world that doesn't have consciousness behind it. There is a form of consciousness creating everything that we experience in this world. And so that was that was her training.
You know, we're going to, this is quite fascinating because, of course, we're at a point in our own intellectual evolution where it's becoming clear to many people that consciousness is indeed the basis of everything. Mm-hmm. And so when we get back, I want to get into a little bit into the issue of what mediumship is, because I've been, of course, I've been exposed to quite a few mediums, including one powerful physical medium who can really make the ghosts dance, and including he can move things around in a room with his mediumship. Quite amazing. I mean, he's a physical medium, as I say. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about the evolution of her mediumship, but I also am interested, there's so many things, folks, Ron had a long relationship with Manly P. Hall, and I think what we're going to do, maybe when we get back, is we're going to first talk about Manly P. Hall a little bit, who is one of the most amazing human beings ever to walk the earth, certainly in the past 200 years. And here we're talking to somebody who was an intimate with him for years. So we'll be right back with Ron Pontiac and many, many other things. For years, we've been told that Close Encounter is a mystery for governments, militaries, intelligence agencies, officials, and scientists to solve behind closed doors. That's not true. The truth is far more powerful and far more personal. Close Encounter happens to ordinary people like me, like you, and our families. People like us, with hopes, homes, fears, and questions that will not go away, that will only be answered in a relationship between us and our visitors. Transformation 2026 is not a book about belief. It is a witness statement. It's the story of what happened when one family had the visitors walk into our lives and stay with us and live with us for 3 years. They didn't sit across a table from us, but they came to us in many extraordinary ways. Transformation 2026 is a chronicle of that experience, updated with all kinds of new information. So it's a book definitely for today, especially if disclosure brings more contact, which it well may. Transformation 2026. Get it. Read it. Decide for yourself what you would do if something as strange as the visitors came walking through your door into your family's life. That happened to me and my family, and we're still here. You're still here, immensely transformed by our experience. So get it from Amazon. Get it from Audible, read by me. But get it. Do that today. We're talking to Ron Pontiac. His book is, his new book is The Unobstructed Way, which is a retelling of an older story, but it is also the reintroduction of some very powerful material that you can use in your life. And why do we need this? Because we live in a world that is dying spiritually. most of us have lost touch with our own souls. We can't feel that part of ourselves. And, you know, when you go online, you find the tech bros are all spending millions of dollars trying to achieve physical immortality because they've lost track of who they are. So, Ron, that gets me to Manly P. Hall, who had very clear ideas about who he is and who he was and who we are. Tell us a little bit about him and how you intersected with him.
Of course. Well, he was a really amazing human being. He began his work when he was 19 years old, and he wrote so many books, gave so many lectures. You can hear many of his lectures on YouTube, and I highly recommend them. He's most famous for a book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages, which was a survey of Western esotericism with beautiful illustrations culled from his incredible collection of books and manuscripts. And he spent decades every Sunday at 11 a.m. delivering a lecture for $1, where he would lecture without notes for 90 minutes about all sorts of subjects, not only Western, but also Eastern. I knew him when he was near the end of his life. I worked for him as his research assistant for 7 years. He was very deeply at that time into Taoism and into Buddhism, you know, Shinto, very much wanting to produce a companion volume to the secret teachings that would represent Eastern esotericism, but unfortunately he was never able to complete it. Before I knew him, I really had two people that changed my life greatly. I was the only child of war survivors. They were atheists, and they had a very, of course, rather paranoid viewpoint of the world. Even though they had moved to America, they didn't trust Americans. So I was raised in isolation, and I was a runt who was born prematurely, and then was kicked up a grade because of my intelligence. So I got beat up throughout my school years. And when I hit my teenage years, I realized that I had no social contract. And as a result, I embraced all the dark arts, lying, violence, even the early form of chaos magic. I started a band that was very popular in Los Angeles that was racist and nihilist. And we had a couple of biker gangs that were supportive of us and acted as my security. And there was a lot of violence around me. I really was on a death trip. I first was very fortunate to meet the woman who had become my wife at a club one night where she had been stranded and was in trouble and looking for someone to save her. And of all things, she looked at me. And even though she was warned by the club manager not to talk to me when he saw her looking at me, he said that this is a really bad guy. At 2 a.m. when the club closed and she was basically surrounded by these five guys, it was a band, who had realized that they could probably victimize her, she decided to ask me for help. It was April 1st, April Fool's Day. I was standing outside dressed all in black, smoking a black Russian cigarette. She said I looked like an anime villain. And she walked up to me, this girl who was obviously out of place, and she said, "Please help me, I'm in trouble." And what a weird moment it was. It was like walking up to the devil and asking for help, but it awoke some chivalry in me. And there was also big karma at play. And so I protected her that night along with my drummer. And then we fell in love. And she left someone who she'd been with since high school for 3 years. She was only 19. And he had a great job. He bought a house at age 19. I was a scumbag. And yet she loved me. And that was the first great moment.
This is a wonderful story.
Well, thank
go
you.
Ahead. I just want to just say really very extraordinary. Go ahead.
Thank you. So she loved me. And this was the first savior in my life. I asked her after 2 weeks to move in with me, and to my shock, she agreed to. And then began the most incredible adventure. We spent 46 years together every single day. We made music together. We made films, documentary films together. We wrote books together. She was a martial artist and a journalist and an activist and an artist. And I just went on for the, I went for a ride, you know, with her. And when I met her, she was very shy. She wouldn't speak when there was a group of people. She thought she was stupid, but she was actually brilliant. And she blossomed through the years. And so about a year after I met her, I had lost interest in violence and lying and all that stuff. But I didn't really know what to do with my life, and she didn't know what to do with hers. We were both cynics, really, about our culture. And I had ran into a copy of The Secret Teachings of All Ages at this great bookstore that no longer exists called The Bodhi Tree.
And such a great store, and its disappearance is a tragedy for all of the West Coast, mainly
agreed.
Us in L.A.
Yes, so true. And so this book changed my life, even from the dedication, which said, to the rational soul of the world, which blew my mind because I thought of the world as a chaotic jungle. And then here was this statement that there was actually a rational soul to the world. And to even contemplate that was something revolutionary to me. And then reading each chapter, seeing that there had been all of these brave souls who had dared to explore a personal relationship with the spiritual and with the divine at a time when you could be executed for heresy when you did that, who had written books and created diagrams and had tried to make sure that we in the future would have the benefit of what they had discovered, moved me deeply. And then I found out that Manly Hall was still lecturing not far from where I lived. And I have to admit that for the first few months after I found out, I was afraid to go because I knew what I had done. I had done really bad things, and I felt very guilty about it. And I just thought I wasn't worthy to be in the presence of someone like that. And Tamara convinced me that I would feel foolish. She said, you know, he's quite an old man. If you wait too long, you may never be able to see him. And how will you feel if you didn't take that opportunity? So one day in spring, we went to the Philosophical Research Society on a beautiful Sunday morning. And it's very interesting because as we were walking, Tamara noticed this crack in the concrete through which a little weed had grown and flowered. And it touched her heart. She had a tremendous relationship with nature. I was dealing with paranoia about California falling into the ocean because a friend of mine, the one who had told me that Manly Hall was still lecturing, was preparing to move to Virginia Beach because the Edgar Cayce readings had scared her, and she thought that California was imminently doomed. So I was spooked by her. So we sit down. We were by far the youngest people there. And out comes this tall, handsome old man and sits down in this chair. During the lecture, he looks right at me and he says, people who suffer paranoia about natural disasters because of the guilt they feel about the life they've been leading. He then looks at Tamara.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That must have been shocking.
It was.
You were already nervous enough being yes. there. So how did that make you feel?
It was very shocking, but also endearing. I felt like somebody had looked into my soul. And he also looked at Tamara a few minutes later during the lecture. And he said, like when a weed grows through a crack in the concrete and produces a beautiful flower. So we both had that experience. I found out later when I worked for him that he couldn't really see us. His vision wasn't very good at that point, and we were colorful blurs to him, basically. And I also found out when I became his screener that many people had this experience. Every time he gave a lecture, he seemed to deliver these personal messages. So Tamara and I were so impressed by the place, by the bookstore, by the library, and by him most of all, that we came the next day, Monday morning, to volunteer. And we offered to do anything. I remember we said, we'll clean toilets. We don't care. We just want to be around here. And they said, well, we don't really need anybody, but let's interview you and see if there's anything we can work out. So Tamara had worked a number of jobs short term. She had office experience. They were very interested in her, but I had nothing useful. And they did ask us, though, do you have any familiarity with languages? And I said, well, I grew up around French and German and Russian and Polish. I don't speak them, but I understand them. And they were like, okay. Next day, they called Tamara and offered her a job. Well, I said, no. I said, if they don't want me, you're not going to go work there while I'm at home with the cats. Forget it. I was that kind
of guy. Yeah, I can understand that.
And so, and she was relieved because she said, you know, I quit those office jobs because I hate that stuff. So that's great. I'm okay with it. And so they called me the next day and said that Manly Hall wanted to meet me. Mind-blowing. So I went down there the next morning, and I walk into his beautiful office filled with art from Japan and China, and he was sitting behind this ornate Chinese desk, carved wood, and there were four elderly women, two on either side of him, with their arms crossed, giving me the skunk eye. But he smiled, and he said, come on in and make yourself miserable. And so he had a stack of paper in front of him, and he pushed it in front of me, and he said, young man, do you know what a galley is? And I said, no. And he said, a galley is how a book starts. And he said, do you know what a bibliography is? And I said, no. And he said, well, a bibliography is like a catalog, and this is the catalog of my collection of alchemical and Rosicrucian books and manuscripts. And he said, I need someone to help me finish editing it. And I think that someone is you. Well, I told him, you know, I'm honored, but I don't have the facility to do this. I haven't had a particularly good education. I just found out about alchemy from reading your book. I don't know anything about it. Then he said, I think you're the right person. He said, why don't you take this manuscript into the library and look it over, and you can come back and tell me what you think. Well, as I walked out, the person who ran the business side of the Philosophical Research Society, Pat Irvin, who had been a former military officer, she must have sprinted around the other side of the library because she got right in front of me as I walked out, and she said, that was a mistake, and she took the paperwork away from me. And I said, yes, I think you're right. Thank you. Well, when I got home, there was another call, and this time it was Manly Hall's secretary, Edith Waldron, and she said, he wants to see you tomorrow morning, first thing. So I went back, and this time it was just him, and he said, young man, you take orders only from me. If anybody contradicts anything that I say to you, you come and tell me. He said, this is what we're going to do. In the morning, I will show you what I want you to work on. At noon, you can have lunch with me in the vault, and you can look at all the books and manuscripts, and I will answer any questions that you have. And then, in the afternoon, before I go home, I will look over your work. And he said, I'm confident that you'll be able to handle this. Well, who would turn down lunch with Manly Hall in the vault? Being able to ask him anything about these incredibly rare books. Today, you can see many of them online, but back then, there was things in there that you could only see in two places in the world, maybe. So I said,
It's still a wonderful place to go.
Absolutely.
The Philosophical Research Society, folks, is well worth a visit if you're in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. So I began working with him.
We're going to get back to the story in just a minute because we do have to take another break now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to explore the work with Manly Hall. We'll get back to that. But before we do that, I'm going to talk about a couple of angels and how they come into the lives of really bad people. We'll be right back.
Where is the unknown country? Is it out there, in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. UnknownCountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on pre-sale on Amazon. You can order it right now. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? What is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate. Then I show they have abilities like telepathy and levitation that we don't have. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. Pre-order the Kindle on Amazon today. It'll arrive in your Kindle on January the 15th. Later, there'll be a paperback, a hardcover, and an audiobook read by me. We're talking to Ronnie Pontiac. He's got a Substack. You can find him on YouTube and on Facebook as well. And, okay, now before we go on, you described a meeting with an angel very similar to the one I had with an angel. Now, that is she became your wife, and she rescued you. My wife, Anne, was the same thing, drifting apparently aimless in the world, in need of help. And you said yes, and I did the same thing. I said yes to my angel. And they stayed with us. And they made our lives possible. We wouldn't have the lives that we did without them. And then they moved on. They moved on, but not completely. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was very strange. Tamara's life trajectory really reflected Betty's in many ways. They had similar qualities in terms of vivaciousness, agelessness, in terms of the incredible rapport with nature. And so when we finished The Unobstructed Way, just as when Betty and Stuart finished one of their most important books, suddenly Tamara, who had been incredibly healthy all her life. She had never seen a doctor for over 40 years. She was so healthy. She suddenly became ill, and she spent 5 days declining here in our house, and then 5 days in the hospital, and then she was gone. And it was completely devastating. She was the source of so much joy and wisdom, and just she opened my eyes to the beauty of life and taught me to appreciate the world. And so without her, suddenly my life was so dark and empty, I didn't know what to do. And the first week was hellish. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was in shock. And then I realized dawn on the Monday morning of the following week that I was going to have to deal with death certificates and cremation and these horrible realities of impermanence in our world. I didn't know how I was going to do it. And I decided to practice something I'd learned from Betty and Stuart, which is to use relaxed appreciation for spiritual contact. And so as I lay there at dawn, I just started speaking out loud to Tamara and telling her all the things that I have loved about her. And I entered a liminal state. There were no detail of where I was. It was just light. And I felt like she got on top of me. And I saw glimpses of her hair and of her shoulder skin, which I think may have been furnished by my memory, that having her presence so close to me, I was automatically seeing what I would expect to see when I was with her. And there was something that I would describe as a soul fusion. It was ecstatic, long-lasting, just amazing, amazing experience. No words were spoken. I knew it was her. I felt filled with love. And she somehow communicated to me her perspective through this experience, which was that these details of mortality were trivial, that they were simply a cleanup after an excursion into the material world, and that her living soul would always be with me. It was a beautiful and transformative experience, but it didn't relieve my terrible loneliness and my longing for her physical presence. We were a very passionate couple who, we never fell out of in love, like we were infatuated with each other all our lives, even to the very end. And so I was still grief-stricken, although I had that connection with her. And so at some point in that second week, I asked her for a sign, just to show me something. Now, we had a lot of conflict over this silly 3.5-foot electric fan that she had, that she would leave on day and night. She loved it. If it was hot, it would cool down the place. If it was cold and we had the heater on, it was stuffy, so she'd use the fan for that. And she had it in the kitchen, so it was good for cooking and keeping it fresh in there. And I had read a review that said that this fan was a potential fire hazard. So I would nag her about, turn that fan off when you leave the room. Don't leave it on all night. You're going to burn the house down. I believe that we all have, men and women, have a neurotic hausfrau in us. It just takes the right conditions to produce it. And the fan did that for me.
That's so true.
And so she gave me a nickname as a result. I would tell her, please don't leave the fan on. She would roll her eyes and say, okay, Mildred. And sometimes she would call herself Mildred. She would say, oh my God, I've gotten all Mildred on this. So when I asked her to show me a sign, first, one of our two cats, which she had just picked out and who had strongly bonded with her and would only respond to her when she called, suddenly perked up her ears and her whole body stiffened like when Tamara would call her. And then she ran into the kitchen right up to the chair that Tamara used to sit in. And I thought, wow, is this the sign? But then about 10 minutes later, that fan turned on by itself. And I checked it. Is there a timer? No. Is the plug loose? No. Could the cats have turned it on? No. And I thought, it is her sense of humor. Of all the things she could have done, she turned on that fan. There was a point of contention. But because of my atheist parents, I still had this skeptical reflex that was very hard for me to deal with.
I can hear that in you and in what you're saying. And, you know, mm-hmm. I do too. I had the same thing. And my wife came back to me very similarly in undeniable ways. And I wrote a book about it called The Afterlife Revolution. Mm-hmm. Or I wrote it with her, I should say. Mm-hmm. And she used to say of this life, for the first things when we really got into contact with each other again, was, Whitley, it's all a game. Mm-hmm. And I think that intersects with what you're saying Tamara was communicating to you.
Yes, absolutely. And she tells me it's all meant to be fun. And she keeps saying to me, let's have some fun. But let me finish the fan story, because it gets really dramatic. So I still felt it, but I had my doubts. And the next day I was talking to a friend of mine who's deeply into the White's work, into the Betty books. And I told him about it. And he said, that is Tamara. That's Tamara's sense of humor. And I said, I know, it really must be. Well, when I went downstairs, the fan was on again. And this happened 9 times, never randomly, always when I spoke to somebody else about this fan incident. So about 2 months later, I got an email from someone who we didn't really know very well. We had slight social media contact. And she said, Ronnie, I have clairvoyant tendencies, but I'm not a medium. I don't really do this. But I've been talking to Tamara for a couple of months. And I finally got up the courage to send you the notes because I want to know if I'm crazy or I'm really talking to Tamara. Well, there were many hits in the notes. For instance, she was laughing because I would not put away the utensils that I used in the morning to get her coffee and her breakfast. It was too painful for me. I got some kind of comfort from seeing them there because it was such a beautiful morning ritual that we had that she really enjoyed. And she conveyed the stuff still sitting there, even though you don't drink coffee, and she thought that was funny. But the line that really stood out to me, that stunned me, was tell Ronnie to tell Mildred that I love her.
Wow, that must have just shaken you to your skeptical shoes.
It did. And
darn right it did.
Yes. And so, and it was also so moving because I was at that point. When you lose someone like that, you can't help but calculate your regrets. And among my regrets was that I had nagged her and earned the nickname Mildred. So her addressing that and telling me that she loves Mildred was so healing for me and so moving. And
this
then
is so moving. Speaking of moving,
thank
Ronnie.
You.
Go ahead. It's beautiful.
So then I started getting all these messages the second week after she passed from other people. I got, for instance, the same message from three different people who were her fans, her music fans, and who didn't know her or me, and who delivered the exact same message on the same day. They all had Tamara say, tell Ronnie to live up to what he knows. Other messages that were repeated by people were, tell him that he's too addicted to my physicality. There was apparitions. People actually saw her. There were audio apparitions. There were lots of electronic manipulation and also strange incidents, especially involving cats, dragonflies, butterflies and such, scarab beetles. And then she was also working, like in her life, she had mentored a number of people, especially women. She would find women who were traumatized or who were drawn to her work and who had been traumatized away from their creativity by people who were jealous or insecure about it. And she would lift them. She would help them to be creative again. But not only that, she would help them to get their books published, to get films made, to start bands. And then she would stay there and had this uncanny ability to reach out when they were suffering and no one knew about it. She had this, when I was doing her testimonials for her celebration of life, there were so many people who said, I hadn't spoken to her for a year, and then I went through this terrible experience, and the next day there was a message from Tamara, hey, how are you doing? And she would help them to realize that they still had a lot to give and that they would have a better life once they moved forward. Well, she's still doing that. I continue to get messages from mostly women who have had her in dreams or in hearing her speak to them, and she helps them with their work. She gave one woman the title of her book. She encourages them to get back to work. She gives them perspective. It's really amazing. And I, you know, for a little bit there in the beginning, I was envious because I wasn't getting direct communications. And I think my grief was just so strong. The density of where I was at was very difficult. But she has been getting through to me, especially in dreams. And I'll just tell you one quick example. So her birthday was December 22nd. And she was one of those kids that would only get presents for Christmas, not for her birthday, because her birthday was too close to Christmas. So I spoiled her all her life. I would spend months every year finding the most incredible presents for her birthday and for Christmas. And so when those days came around, I felt so bereft. I slipped back into some of my old anger, and I just felt terrible. And on New Year's Eve night, I had a dream. Again, nothing but light. And she was across from me. And I said to her in my miserable state, "Do you see how much pain I'm in?" And she said, "Yes, I'm watching you. And the show sucks."
Yeah, show sucks.
And that really...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that snapped me out of it. I woke up laughing. And then since then, I've been in a different state because I want to put on a good show for Tamara. I want her to watch me and feel pride and love. And I want to be the best Ronnie that I've ever been so that she's eager to see me and be with me again. And so I'm working very much now to get a deep communication because I depended on her for everything, for the music, for the writing, for the film. She was an invaluable partner in all of it, my best editor. She was an incredible lyricist and a great guitar player, a great rhythm guitarist. And I needed her to make my work better. And so now I feel that I need that collaboration to keep the work at the level that it was always at, because there are several books that we were working on that are unfinished, and I want to finish them. But to do it properly, I need her. So I'm now, through meditation and using exercises in the White's books, I'm working very steadily toward improving my own ability to access what in the Betty books they called unobstructed consciousness.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going down a vortex. We'll be right back. The president has directed the Defense Department to release all of its documents involving UFOs and aliens. There are rumors that this might actually happen, and even that they might tell the truth. If you read the Whitley Strieber Substack or my most recent blog on unknowncountry.com, I explain exactly why. But if it does happen, does it also mean direct contact with aliens for more people? What happens if they come into your life, your children's lives? It's not going to be abductions like it was in the past. It's going to be a very different experience. Something much more like what happened to my family after the communion experience. I wrote two books about it, Transformation and Breakthrough. They were beaten to death by the media and not much read, but they remain the only chronicle of such an experience that has ever been put into print. They're a blueprint for how to make contact work, and it can work, and that is certainly very important. Governments come and governments go, but the visitors are going to be in our lives from now on, forever. So how do we handle this? Is it good? Bad? Are we in danger? Or at the start of something wonderful? Find out how one family made contact work in Transformation 2026, the massive update to the original book, available now on Amazon.com. All right, Ronnie, I have promised my listeners and viewers a journey down a vortex. This is a very important concept in your thinking. Can you explain it a little bit and amplify it a bit?
Yes. So in the teachings in the Betty books, basically the universe as we know it has two sides to it. For the living, it's the obstructed universe where our brain, our senses, the density of the frequencies that surround us limit our ability to understand the world. And then we have this other side of our consciousness, which we experience upon death, but which we can experience during life, which is unobstructed. And this is described as the ability to know everything, to be anywhere, to have consciousness of the future and the past as well as the present. And it's something that in the Betty books is described this way beautifully. It's like when you go camping and it's nighttime and there's a cloudy sky, let's say, maybe it's the new moon. So everything is dark. There's no color. It can be claustrophobic. You don't see any horizon. You just see what's immediately around you. And for the most part, it's black and gray. But then the sun comes up and you can see the mountains far away, purple in the morning light. And you can see the splendor of the sky as the clouds clear. And you can see all the gorgeous colors of the forest. And you can hear all the birds that suddenly come to life. And this was the comparison between the obstructed view of the universe and the unobstructed view. Another example that Betty gave was the obstructed experience of the universe is like a black and white photograph, and the unobstructed is like a color movie. So this leads to two kinds of experience of the world. When you're in the body and you're in the obstructed, it could be described as a claustrophobia of the soul. The soul longs to be free, to have its eternal consciousness, which originated and still to some degree exists outside time. That's why human beings, after millions of years of evolution, we just don't get it. Even my father, who was a total atheist and didn't believe in spirituality, I once asked him, when you look in the mirror, he was an old man at this time, do you have a sense of surprise at what you see? Do you still feel within you the young man that you were? And he said, yes, I do understand what you're saying. And for most of us, that's how it is. We never expect to age and die, although we tend to, according to the Betty books, we hypnotize each other. They called aging a superstition and said that we kind of hypnotize each other into aging together. But for most of us, we experience this world as a scary place. It's competitive. It's heartless. It's a jungle which we have to fight to survive in. And we don't think we have any kind of help. And accidents happen that are terrifying. And so we worry about our loved ones. And this creates a form of consciousness which they call the vortex. You get sucked into it. It's chaotic. It's a maelstrom. And we're seeing it today in the world. We're overwhelmed by potential disasters in every way we look. And it makes it very hard to live and very hard to live a good life. And so as a result, the worst qualities of human beings are emphasized. Competitiveness and anger and mockery of each other and fear. And we rattle our nervous systems and deplete our bodies. And so this vortex can be something that we get sucked into as simply as meeting someone who's cruel to us. You know, there's somebody in the office or there's someone in our family who has a cruel personality, and or they're fearful and their fear is contagious, or their anger is contagious. Or we can simply get on social media and there's tons of it displayed for us by the algorithm, and we can waste half our lives in doom scrolling and responding to people that we disagree with and getting into flame wars with people and such. And that's the vortex. It leads to sickness. It leads to not only actions that cause damage in the world and to ourselves, but it also leads to a kind of omission, sins of omission. The things that we came here to do, the mission that we incarnated to accomplish, doesn't get done. We forget about it. We forget that there is a mission at all. And so that work goes undone, and it makes the world a more difficult place, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. And when millions of people fail to accomplish their missions, the world goes off track, and terrible things can happen. So part of the Betty Book's teaching was how to get out of the vortex. And not only that, but how to become the opposite, how to provide a presence that leads to what they called spiritual contact and spiritual vitality and spiritual stability. One of the examples they gave was, it's like going into a hospital room. And for many of us, if we're visiting somebody that we care about in a hospital, we can be overcome with claustrophobic and hypochondriac feelings. But if you go in there and you bring your own health and your own spiritual stability and spiritual vitality, you can actually help the person who's sick, because this conveys to them and it awakens within them their own unobstructed soul, which continues to be there and exist outside of time. And they believed, for example, that the reason Betty, and I think this was true of Tamara also, that these two women stayed so youthful all their lives was because they were so strongly connected to their souls. The unobstructed spirit in them was so strong that it filled their bodies with this vitality. And so they did not have the normal experience that people who are living in the claustrophobia of the vortex have.
Well, that is really, really well described. And thank you. I think that we all are appreciative of this, because one of the key things about the book is that it is a blueprint for taking the journey out of this vortex. And a big part of it is noticing that you are in it, and also that there is something else that's real. And in that context, I want to bring up Carl Jung, because of it surprised me that he would have had anything to say at all about Betty's communications, but he did. And can you tell us about his trajectory with Betty, the Betty material?
Yeah, it is very interesting. It's hardly ever talked about that Jung was a spiritualist. His very first dissertation was about his 13-year-old cousin who was doing seances that he organized. Now, he characterized these as personality traits that had sort of come off of her unconsciousness, and he actually damaged her life because he described her too carefully, and people recognized that it was her and considered her to be crazy, so nobody would marry her. But later in life, he also experienced channeling with his Gnostic books, and he had experiences with hauntings. And his mother was somebody who had major psychic experiences, and her father was so aware of spirits that he used to make her stand behind him when he wrote sermons so the spirits wouldn't bother him. But as far as the Betty books, so the evidence for this is sprinkled here and there. He had written about them. We know that he gave them to his colleagues and recommended these books. Now, when he wrote about them publicly, he took a kind of agnostic stance on them. He would complain about Stuart's writing. He apparently agreed with Tamara. And he also would say things like, well, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff here, but spiritualism remains unproven, and who knows. But then privately, he wrote in letters and in other places some really surprising things. So, for example, he wrote a letter in 1950 to someone, and he said, it's only physical phenomena that happen in a distinct place at a distinct time, whereas the spirit is eternal and everywhere. That could have been taken right out of the Betty books. He had a few years earlier, I think it was about 11 years earlier, he had written another letter to a pastor whose brother had died in Africa and who had shown up and had a conversation with his astonished brother. And it disturbed the pastor so much that he wrote Jung. And Jung wrote him back and he said that the psyche does not exist entirely in time and space. He said that he thought that the bulk of the psyche, what he called the unconscious, exists in a state of relative spacelessness and timelessness. This is, again, could be taken right out of the Betty books. And then you see he wrote in one place that the most interesting book was to him, The Unobstructed Universe, and he recommended that and the other Betty books to anyone interested in the psychology of the unconscious. And then he said this book, The Road I Know, was a great introduction to Jung's own active imagination therapy, which he'd been using for 30 years in the treatment of neurosis. But my favorite find was he had written in a letter to his friend Fritz Kunkel, and he said, when asked about the Betty books, that he thought that, how did he put it? He said, I must own that with regard to Betty, I'm hesitant to deny her reality as a spirit. That's to say, I am inclined to assume that she is probably more a spirit than archetype, although presumably she represents both at the same time. And this was about the posthumous Betty. So in other words, yes. Jung is saying that he considers Betty's communications from beyond as evidence of the survival of consciousness after death.
Wow. Well, this has been a great discussion. I really have enjoyed it. The unobstructed way. How do we find our way? We are all searching in some way for this. Those of us who are on the close encounter spectrum are searching for a way in because we know the door is there. We've been taken through it many times, but then we can't find it when we come back. Ronnie, thank you for your wisdom, for being with us, and for sharing tomorrow with us as well, and your experience with Manly Hall. It's a wonderful journey, the unobstructed way. Get it, folks. It's well worth your time. It was worth mine, for sure.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.